WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. House Republicans again begin the nomination process for a new speaker 3 weeks after Kevin McCarthy was ousted. CBS's Allison Key says it comes after an unexpected development earlier today.
Minnesota Congressman Tom Emmer won the most votes from Republicans Tuesday morning to become House Speaker nominee, but hours later he was out. Former President Trump called Emmer a rhino, or Republican in name only, and Georgia Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene says a speaker should reflect the views of voters who back Trump.
Republican voters largely support President Trump.
Others say they couldn't support one of the most moderate members of the GOP conference. Allison Keyes, CBS News, Washington.
Israeli troops are stationed along the border with Gaza ahead of an anticipated ground invasion. Israel has increased their airstrikes in Gaza, where the humanitarian crisis is getting worse. CBS's Charlie Daggett in Tel Aviv.
Some of the Israeli military's heaviest bombardment yet in Gaza. The IDF claiming more than 400 targets were struck over the past day, including anti-tank missile launchers and observation posts, pushing the death toll in Gaza to nearly 6,000, according to Hamas health officials.
Michael Cohen testifies in former President Trump's civil fraud trial that he worked to boost Trump's asset values to whatever Trump wanted. Cohen, Trump's former fixer, is considered a key witness in New York Attorney General Letitia James's lawsuit. CBS's Robert Costa says Trump...
He did not ever seem to look at Cohen much. They did not have much eye contact from what we could tell here at CBS News. Instead, it was more of an icy tension in the room about what was unfolding as Cohen detailed all of this alleged fraud.
Former Trump attorney Jenna Ellis pleads guilty to reduced charges for trying to overturn former President Trump's 2020 election loss in Georgia. Assistant DA Daisha Young asks Ellis if she was clear with all the conditions of the agreement.
That you testify truthfully at all hearings or trials involving co-defendants, that you have no communication with co-defendants, witnesses, or the media until all cases have been closed.
Yes.
Ellis is the fourth Trump co-defendant to accept a plea deal. Joseph Emerson, the off-duty U.S. pilot accused of trying to shut down the engines of a Horizon plane mid-flight over the weekend, pleads not guilty to 83 counts of attempted murder. According to court documents, Emerson told police he was having a nervous breakdown, hadn't slept in 40 hours, was battling depression, and had consumed magic mushrooms 2 days earlier. The United Auto Workers strike expands to a GM factory in Arlington, Texas, where Keith Crowell works.
We're standing up. We stand up for the working class. It's not just GM workers. We stand up for all working class across America. Corporate greed has gone too far, and they want to leave us behind.
This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed, because Indeed's all-in-one hiring solution helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
U.S. Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Don't let biased algorithms, or degree screens, or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
Hey, son. How are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ed Council and Pivotal Ventures.
It's What's on Tap for the Chippewa Valley.
93.5.
The Tap. 93.5. The Tap.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, could potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here. I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Know about it.
Doesn't appear to be so.
Well, that's what being a climate denier is all about. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Hey, we had a speaker nominee. Well, then we didn't. Interesting way that. And now the old guy coming back with a new scheme. Well, Republicans in chaos. What else is new? Just what the wealth class loves. Broken government led by our Republican friends. Because, hey, the more status quo we are, the more broken our government is, the less we're going to hold corporate America responsible for all the destruction and the poor wages, and the more we're not going to tax the very wealthy. So, hey, the best money democracy can buy, the best government democracy can buy, our corporate money going into destroying our government. But here's the thing. Workers are having enough. And, you know, we tell these stories all the time. Today, the UAW put another 5,000 General Motors workers on the picket line, this time in Arlington, Texas. And again, I think we're going to see more of this as this strike continues. Eventually, who knows where this goes? It's been over 6 weeks now. It's time to come to an agreement, Big Three. How much do you have to lose? And this is the part that's amazing to me, because how much do you have to lose before you go, it's worth making a reasonable deal? How much do you have to lose? And this is one of those things that's always amazing to me when you see these kind of strikes happen. And I'm always taken by the one hospital up in, I think it was Buffalo, where they spent like $10 million trying to break the strike, where just giving the nurses everything that their little hearts could have ever dreamed of would have cost them $5 million. You go, oh, what sense does that make? Well, it's all about power. It's all about control. You'll get what you get and you won't throw a fit. You'll get what we give you and you'll be back in your place. You'll be happy to have a job. You won't make any waves. Yeah, that's where we are. And look, I'm glad people have had enough. I'm glad people are finally stepping up and saying, you know what? Enough is enough already. There's only so far you can push people. And, you know, I was just talking about this with a friend. I was going, you know, because we were talking about, you know, the wages from when we were younger to where they are now. And look, when I was younger, work made your life better. You got a job, life got better. You got a good job, you were able to pay your rent, you were able to pay for, you got a reasonable car to drive, you had money to go out on Friday nights, your life got better. And you got that union job, your life got really, really better. And look, that was my story. You know, got a crummy job getting out of high school, went into college, still had a crummy job. I got that union job, and it's like, that's money. In fact, you know, dollar for dollar, I had more disposable income, you know, when I was, you know, 21, 22, than I have when I'm 56. Because the wages were much different. The distribution of wealth in this country, go back to the late 80s, was much different. The working class got much more of the wealth that their labor created. And the way I think this is important is I think people are finally waking up to that fact. And I know we see the signs, you know, McDonald's is hiring for, you know, $18 an hour. Yeah, they probably should be, because they are in other countries. But I stopped by a gas station today. And this is one of those things that doesn't happen often. I've seen, I know it's happening a lot in this country, but this is the first that I've seen it in a while. I stopped in to get some gas and grab a drink. And the woman behind the counter had to, you know, probably be in her early to mid 20s. You know, you could see just the look in her face of just, you know, she didn't know what to do. She was so frustrated. This customer was giving her the business, and I don't know what was going on, but I saw his hands flailing around and her just with this dead look on her face. Like, you know what? I've heard this too many times. There's nothing I can do about it. Why are you yelling at me? That kind of thing. And she just turned around. It looked like she used the F word and just basically goes, I'm leaving. And she walked out. And I'm like, wow, I guess good on her. I hope the best for her. So I go up and I pay for my drink. And I ask the person, I go, what was that all about? He goes, well, third time that's happened this month. Because people are finally getting tired of dealing with people. Because I couldn't do the job. There's no way I would put up with an angry person. And here's the thing. Most of the time, what the customer who's supposed to be, they believe they're always right, what they beat up on the clerk or the person doing the job is nothing that person can change. They have literally no power to make that situation better. And even if they bring the supervisor in, they probably have very little power to make you happy or right. And this got me thinking today that, you know, maybe this is what it's going to take. We've gone through the great resignation. They say we're in a great reset where workers are doing this. I'm finally tired of the constant BS and the poverty level wages. And my mind was going through this place today as I'm going, well, this place probably pays, I don't know, $15 to $17 an hour, maybe. No health care, no retirement, no vacation, no sick time, none of that stuff. But just, you know, an okay, I guess, wage. Something you could, you know, maybe just be poor working at. Not your life's getting any better, but you're existing, you're surviving, you're scraping together an existence, paying your rent, paying for the jalopy car, you know, putting some crummy food on the table. But life isn't getting better. And this is the key point for most working people. They get up, they go through the grind, they bust their behinds, and life doesn't get better. They don't see the light at the end of the tunnel. They don't see the prize at the end of the road. There's no reward at the end of this. And this is why working people, I think this is why we're fed up. And as I've said, look, you know, most people in this country, you know, they have jobs that keep them poor. Just surviving, just getting by while corporate America, now this is a giant corporation, while corporate America is raking in enormous profits, doing massive stock buybacks, paying their CEO outrageous sums. And there they are, the people on the front lines actually doing the work who can't afford to go to the doctor, probably have medical debt like 100 million people in this country. Don't have the ability to take vacations or sick time when they're sick or when their kids get sick. So they're just worried about one bump in the road that could send their lives into chaos. But here they are. They got to show up with a smile on their face and deal with someone who, just like them, is in a crummy job that's not making the bills, and they're ticked off about the price of stuff, and it's not a good recipe. It is a horrible situation, and this is what happens when you have really two classes of people, the very, very rich and everybody else. And everybody else, I'm thinking, struggling. And, you know, George Carlin always talks about, you know, you've got the rich who pay none of the taxes, take all of the profits, the middle class who does all the work and pays all the taxes, and then the poor who are there to scare the you-know-what out of the middle class, so they keep showing up to these crummy jobs. And, you know, this is one of those things, again, we, by policy, keep people desperate and poor. And, you know, you've seen homeless people on the side of the road. I've heard this a lot from, well, why don't they get a job? And you go, well, because it's not that easy to just go get a job, especially if you're homeless. And, oh, by the way, big giant secret here. And I know this is going to be a shock to some, but the majority of those people are homeless. They've got jobs. They got those crappy jobs, those crummy jobs that don't have any way to get out of poverty. So when I saw this, you know, my mind is in this whole, you know, how do we fix this? Because I'm a man and I'm like, how do we fix this? How do we change this dynamic? And I keep coming back to, you know, maybe if we started organizing these retail workers, because you know what? I go back to my grandmother. My grandmother, who in the 1960s helped organize a union in her workplace. They had good wages, family-sustaining wages. Single mothers were the majority of the workforce in that, back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Single mothers earned a wage that they could live on, got health care, got retirement security, got vacations. When my grandmother retired in 1980, she was making just about $8, a little over $8 an hour, had 6 weeks vacation, had full eye, full dental, full medical, and a retirement, so that when she retired, she was able to live in her home her final years with dignity and respect. That's the thing that's amazing to me. And why can't we demand that now? Why can't we say enough of this dynamic where we work and slave and do all of this stuff to make a handful of people outrageously wealthy? Why don't we talk about how do we distribute this wealth in a way that makes everybody's lives better, especially the people who are working for a living? How come we're not doing that? How come we're not moving in that direction? And as I say, you want to reunite this country? Let's reunionize this country. Let's get people back in the workplace fighting for better wages, hours, conditions, so no worker is in a position to where they go up, show up to work 40 hours a week, busting their behind, and still live in desperation and poverty. How about we do that? I know, but Rick, we're more concerned about who goes to what bathroom and who wears a dress, and we're concerned about that stuff. It's ridiculous, it's stupid, and we should stop it. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Got a lot to get to. Oh, lots of craziness today and lots of entertainment. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, I come back to, you know, where we've been and in all of this. And I think it's important that we wake up to the reality that working people have finally, hopefully had enough. Let's go to Steve in Chicago on line two. Steve, how you doing?
Fine.
You just hung up on Steve. You got to put them on hold. Let's go to line one. Let's see who we got here. TJ, how are we doing?
Hey, Rick. TJ Sandell from the Great Lakes Building Trades in Erie.
What's on your mind, TJ?
How you doing?
I'm good.
Well, the answer is organizing. I mean, that's what has to happen. And I think that these Gen Z kids that are coming up now are seeing what the reality is in the temperature of this country as far as jobs go. So they're realizing with Starbucks and all these big corporations that are taking advantage of them, they're seeing that organizing works.
No, and that's important. And this is what I keep saying, TJ, that if we want to reunite this country, if we wanted to do the positive things, you know, we've got to organize them. And somehow we just lost TJ for some reason. I appreciate the call, TJ. We'll try it again. We got Steve on line two, right? Yeah. Let's go to Steve on line two. Steve, how are you?
Fine, thank you. So I wanted to make a couple of points. And people need to understand, as you've rightly pointed out, most of the people who we consider to be homeless are in fact working. And the unofficial standard is if you're paying more than 30% of what you make every year for housing, then you're housing challenged. And a lot of people have to resolve that by ending up in the street, sleeping in their car, sleeping on someone's couch. And we count them as homeless. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. There are plenty of people who we consider to be homeless who are working every day. Beyond that, then, what we're seeing is sort of the typical corporate backlash against, you know, what we've seen as a reinvigoration of the union movement in this country. So from UPS to the United Auto Workers to SAG-AFTRA, and so many other unions that are standing up finally after generations of being stomped upon. Well, you know, they're standing up, and already you're starting to see the backlash from these corporations that are sending out these messages through think tanks and through conservative media. Oh, if the prices for what you're paying is going up, you know, you can blame the unions. It's their fault. And it's so typical, you know, that we've seen this in cycle after cycle in this country.
And yet the reality is you go, and I used to love talking about the fact that when the Janestown automotive plant was open, the Chevy Suburban that was built there and in Mexico, depending on where it was built, didn't matter. The price was still the same. So if you were paying a union worker in Janesville, Wisconsin, a living wage with health care and retirement and all of those things, didn't matter in the price because you were paying a portion of that to the worker in Mexico. The corporation still made out, and the consumer got screwed, and the worker got screwed in this country when they closed the plant. So for me, I think it's about time people are waking up to these realities. I just wish it didn't. I wish we didn't have to go through the pain and the struggle that we're going to go through.
Yeah, I mean, at one time in this country, people sort of understood the notion of why they were paying more. You know, so okay, well, Henry Ford decides to pay X amount to his workers. Okay, so I'm paying this amount for the car. Okay, Henry Ford's making out like a bandit, but still, you know, he's paying his workers a decent wage. You know, it wasn't because he was an altruist. It was because he had some common sense with regard to how businesses function, something that doesn't exist all that much in the modern world. But today, as you point out, you know, when I'm a BMW guy, so I love BMWs. That's what I tend to buy and drive. But, you know, my BMW can be, it's not made in Germany anymore with the highest standards of quality. A lot of them are made in Mexico and made other places. But you know what? They don't cost any less.
Exactly.
So, you know, you're rightfully pointing this out. I mean, we've outsourced a lot of this stuff to the cheapest possible labor in the world. And by the way, it's not only the case that we have done it to just one country. Every generation or so, when a country's wages tend to go up too high. So in other words, now China has become too expensive to make a lot of the things that we want. So we move on to somewhere else, like Vietnam. And then we'll move on to another country. We'll constantly move on to whatever is the lowest common denominator, the race to the bottom. Now, we've had that in this country, but there's also a race to the bottom in terms of, you know, where you make things internationally.
No, exactly. I appreciate the thought, Steve. Thanks so much. And look, he's exactly right. We've corporate America. They don't care about this country. They run ads. You know, we're all in for America. But they're more than happy to source their things from overseas and ship them back here and assemble it here so they can say, made in America. And we buy it. I mean, the sad reality is we need better policymakers. Let's go to line three. We got Kurt on line three. Kurt, how are we doing today?
I'm doing okay. I'm sorry to hear that you're going to be going off the air, hopefully temporarily, on December 1st. I enjoy listening to you every night.
Well, this is a positive thing, Kurt. You know, we're looking at the fact that we're moving to TV. We're right, making the jump to video. This is going to be a good thing, I think.
And it'll be free speech TV, and people, you can get it online if you have a Roku as well, if you don't have satellite. But anyway, it comes down to education. We are not taught labor education in this country like we used to be. It was part of our labor history. We are not taught labor history. It was part of our history that we were taught prior to a certain time. And that's a lot of the problem.
No, I don't know that I'm on board completely with that, because I go back to my schooling. The only thing I really learned about labor education was about the Molly Maguires, and I learned they were all criminals.
Right. Right.
When you go back and you go, no, they weren't criminals. These were just people who were desperate. They were working in deplorable conditions. If you've ever taken a coal mine tour, and these were people who were basically fighting for their lives. I think we need labor education in the school. I'm 100% with you on that.
Right. And you know what? I'll say something. The closest in this generation that we can come to those deplorable labor situations would be when we were having quote unquote essential workers who were heroes at the time during COVID, had to go to the hospitals, had to drive the public buses, had to go to the meat packaging plants, all that stuff, and risk their health and their family's health. And for what? To get pay cuts. I mean, my goodness, I was making bonuses every month prior to April of 2020. And then we had to have a department meeting where they said, because of the COVID situation, we're cutting the monthly bonuses indefinitely. I think the boss thought it was easier to say that because everyone's getting a $1,200 check. And I'm hearing people say, I'm just grateful I have a job. I'm just grateful I'm working right now, that sort of thing. And it shouldn't have been that way. And to make it worse was about 6 weeks later, the boss announces that they hired a new vice president of operations for that company. Talk about a slap in the face to your workers. So by December, I'm thinking, you know, I haven't missed a day. I never got COVID, knock on wood. I never missed a day. I was going to a hospital every day during that COVID situation. I need to get something out of this. And so I actually wrote a proposal to get a raise. And I think I'm the only person that could probably in that company get away with saying this. I actually imposed FDR's Four Freedoms speech in my proposal for why I needed a raise. So, which I couldn't believe that it worked. But what it was is I knew I needed at least $1.50 an hour more. I went in asking for $1.75, knowing I wasn't going to get $1.75. You know, at the end of the day, I actually ended up getting $1.48. I decided I'm not going to cry over 2 cents, but I got close to what I wanted.
Good for you. Most people are not that fortunate.
Right. And then, you know what? I still have not missed a day for COVID or anything like that. And, you know, I'm still going to the hospital and seeing sick people and trying to get them Medicaid or get them what they need as far as getting their hospital bills paid. But what I'm getting at is, I don't know where I'm getting at with this. I'm starting to ramble like Donald Trump incoherently here. But what I'm getting at is it shouldn't be this way. And, you know, you're right. The workers do need to start standing up, but you know, it comes down to what we've been conditioned to believe is as long as the rich get everything they want, the poor get everything they want, nothing's going to change because the middle class do not have the time nor the funds to go out and start marching. And I guess we're going to need to find the time and the funds to do it.
No, that's why I think what's going on with the UAW is so important. Why I think when you're the Teamsters and UPS, why that fight was so important, that you're raising expectations that a job should make lives better. And I've been saying this for all 18 years that I've been doing this program. You know, every time a new president comes in, my goal for them is to return reward to work. That a job is going to make your life better, not worse, not keep you in poverty, not keep you marching in place. but actually making lives better. And I'm hoping we, we get back to that place.
And, you know, I'm fortunate. My wife and I are fortunate. We're able to afford to purchase a home. Well, we're buying the home right now. But we also got in under a great 3.9% interest rate when we did it, too. Have you seen what the cost of rent is anymore in this country?
No. We bought a house because my daughter couldn't afford rent anywhere. You know, the sad reality is you know, there's nothing out there that's affordable, you know, for you know, people starting out, young families. We've got real problems. And I come back to a lot of it is policy driven. We should be building low-cost housing like they did back in the 50s when my grandparents came back from World War II. We should be doing
a lot of
things.
And that's what Harry Truman fought for back in 1948. And he called the Republicans out on this, saying they say they're for the American home, but not public housing. They say they're for public. They say they're for people getting health care, but not for everybody. They say they're for the American way of life, just so long as it doesn't spread to all the folks.
Exactly.
Sort of stuff.
You were spot on, Kurt. Appreciate the call, man. Always good stuff. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1936. That was the day Londoners referred to as the Battle of Cable Street. By some accounts, as many as 250,000 trade unionists, radicals, and anti-fascist fighters joined together to protest Sir Oswald Mosley's British Union of Fascists. The fascists planned to march in black shirt uniform through London's then heavily Irish and Jewish working class East End neighborhood. Mosley's BUF scapegoated Jews for the economic crisis brought on by the Great Depression. He had drawn thousands to rallies in previous years, and now looked to impose fascist dominance over the most vulnerable of Londoners. Bill Fishman, a Jewish activist and son of an immigrant tailor who was there on that day, recollected, quote, "I was moved to see the bearded Jews and Irish Catholic dockers standing up to stop Mosley. I shall never forget that as long as I live, how working class people could get together to oppose the evil of fascism." The Metropolitan Police stationed as many as 10,000 policemen to keep counter-protesters from directly confronting the BUF. But the anti-fascists physically blocked every possible path into the East End. They constructed barricades along Cable Street made from paving stones and household furniture. Women emptied garbage bags and chamber pots from windows onto the fascists. Marbles were thrown in the direction of the fascists and their protectors. Seamen pulled out their lorries and turned them on their side. Tram drivers parked and abandoned their streetcars in the middle of the street to prevent the fascists from continuing their march. Protesters chanted the slogan of the Spanish Civil War, "No pasarán," or "They shall not pass." And that day, the fascists did not pass. They were stopped by the power of working people.
There is nothing quite as pitiful as whiny billionaires. And the whiniest of all is the richest, Elon Musk. This self-entitled bully runs over anyone in his way, then whines when they protest. Elon's latest high-pitched screech was prompted by public demands that his profiteering schemes obey clean water and safety regulations. He owns a corporation named, believe it or not, the Boring Company, an underground tunneling venture based in Bastrop, Texas, digging out tons of soil chemicals and contaminated groundwater. But where to put all the waste? "I'll just dump the stuff in the nearby Colorado River," said Lord Musk. "Lots of stuff, 140,000 gallons of wastewater per day." "But that river is our main water source," said local people. "You'll need to comply with water treatment and disposal rules." "Outrageous," whined Elon, maniacally squealing that construction is becoming practically illegal in America. So he proceeded to dump his waste without a permit. Then he encountered Chap Ambrose, a boring neighbor and former Musk admirer. Chap began asking questions and getting nothing but evasions, lies, and disrespect. Musk was messing with Texas, so Ambrose rallied local opposition through a website he named Keep Bastrop Boring. With a drone, he videoed Musk's expanding industrial mess, broadcasting the videos throughout the area. He filed actions with county, state, and national regulatory authorities and got his state senator to hold a hearing attended by hundreds of residents in this rural county. Musk can bamboozle powerful officials, but not feisty people like Chapp, who recently ridiculed the pouty billionaire. Development remains legal in Bastrop, Ambrose told him, but what is illegal is polluting Texas water. You're making this way harder than it has to be. This is Jim Hightower saying the fight goes on, and I'm betting on Chapp.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So over the last couple of days, gotten a lot of response over Jon Stewart not being able to do his program. And you know, as I said from the beginning, I give Stewart the utmost credit for standing up and saying, look, we're going to talk about China. We're going to talk about AI. Don't care what your corporate agenda is. And this, again, is the problem with corporate-controlled media. The fact that we've got six corporations that control 90% of what we see, hear, and read, it's these things that I don't think gets enough attention. Had Stewart been a go-along, get-along guy, had he been, oh, I don't know, on one of the F channels or one of those over there, we may have never heard this. This would have just gone under the radar, and he would have followed along like a good minion. But I give him credit for standing up and saying, nope, not going to do it. And here to share some thoughts on maybe my next guest shares my enthusiasm and my love of Jon Stewart, especially on this. That's why I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, great to be with you. And yes, I am a big Jon Stewart fan. You bet.
And I think this, for me, this, especially this, this is one of the main reasons. This is a guy who lives his values. He walks the walk, yes, while talking the talk. That to me is the important thing.
Yeah, I mean, he does. Jon Stewart, first of all, he's funny. He's relevant. He cares deeply about humanity in very tangible ways, and also exploring really complex issues or issues that don't get a lot of attention. And he's not afraid to dive in deep, even if it's going to mean, you know, getting his hands dirty. And so what really struck me, Rick, and, you know, is the fact, and I think it sounds like your listeners probably know this, that his show on Apple is done. Right. I mean, and they had extraordinary episodes about a lot of issues. But, you know, what little we know about the departure, one of it is because he probably wanted to tackle something very serious about China. And Apple, with all of its dependency on China for manufacturing and for buying some phones as well, and being able to continue to, you know, sell Apple products in China was probably mortified.
Yeah. Especially the AI component as well. I mean, you know, Apple, I'm sure they've got a plan for AI. Right. Yeah. So, you know, China, where their money comes from, and AI, their control mechanism, they don't want anybody knowing anything about this. So, of course, shut it down.
Which is obviously, you know, this is the danger of all of these different entities kind of owning streaming or media channels, is that their ability to have either tacit or direct kind of censorship over content is something that we shouldn't underestimate the impact or the chilling effect that could have. And so it is my hope is that Jon Stewart can find another home. And that he can do some of this work. But good for him for stepping away, because I'm sure from a financial, from a prestige perspective, there are all sorts of things he had to consider. Wasn't easy to do, obviously. Not everybody's in a position to do that. But he did the right thing. And Tim Cook and the folks that are running the programming for Apple Plus TV, really screwed it up here. But I mean, you know, they do this consistently with respect to China. They bend over backwards with respect to China, and then they make demands of our own government, which is something that really, you know, gets my blood boiling, Rick.
No, I mean, he, you know, this is why I love John Stewart. Again, a guy who stands on his values. He could have done the John Cena and learned Mandarin to apologize for the having the audacity to, yeah, you know, actually want to talk about things that are wrong in China, but he didn't, and I give him credit for that.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. And so there's not a lot of folk like that. I think Keanu Reeves has done some stuff in the past, and Richard Gere did a long time ago. And there's others along the way, Brad Pitt, who have made some noise about China. And good for all of those folks. But it's few and far between in pop culture and among celebrities to do this, just because of the threats, you know, the very credible threats that the China or countries that have an interest in operating there will make. So, but I think the reason why it's just interesting to talk about in general is that this is a real problem, and we're going to see more of this. And so I think that we have to find a way as a U.S. government to have the backs, yeah, of people who want to speak out about this and make sure they have the channels to do that, because censorship, whether it's in the hands of the Chinese Communist Party or you know, in one of our largest media and tech companies, is a dangerous thing.
No, I absolutely agree. And this leads us to my next topic, because, you know, there was an interesting opinion over at the Washington Post that the era of cheap is over. And a lot of that has to do, I think, with China, especially on the labor front, as we're starting to say, no, we want to be sourcing things at home. We want to talk about domestic production for domestic consumption, thing that I've been very, very, very high on. So, you know, the end of cheap labor is over. The end of cheap money is over. What kind of an economy are we going to have once that realization sets in?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like by the way, I hope your listeners get a chance to look at this column. It's by Rana Farrar, who is writes an opinion column for the Financial Times, and she's been published elsewhere. Very, very smart about this stuff. Cares deeply about these issues. I've had a number of good conversations with her, but the point she makes is exactly that: is that Wall Street ran our economy, and as a result, we had cheap money. There was artificially cheap energy in a lot of different ways, and cheap labor because of all the exploitation and the tax on unions here at home, and the exploitation abroad made possible by many of our trade and economic policies, and that there is now a reversal of that underway. And it's going to cause gripes at first. And you hear this, I do too, like gas costs too much, or housing costs too much, or food costs. There's lots of reasons for that. But ultimately, and I think this is Rana's point, is that we're going to restore some balance in our economy. It's going to be more Main Street and working class focused. And we're going to focus on having good wages and maybe buying products that are not as disposable, right? And that are made a little closer to home.
And made a little bit better.
Yeah, and made a little better. So ultimately, yeah, you're not going to go out and buy, you know, 20 plastic widgets that you're going to throw away the next day. You might only buy one or two things, but they're going to last for a long time. And they're going to be made by workers who are earning a decent wage, who will then be able to buy things of their own.
Yep. No,
and it's like, yeah, I mean, it's a virtuous idea, but I'm glad that she presented it, and I hope people are paying attention.
I know a guy who replaces HVAC units, and he mm-hmm. says, you know, we're going into homes now because of Biden's policy and the rebates that come out of it. You know, we're going into homes with much more fuel efficient, much more efficient, you know, heat pumps. And we're going in and we're taking out, you know, units that are 30, 35 years old, and we're putting in ones that their lifespan is going to be about 7-8 years long because of the cheap stuff that it's made with, and this idea of planned obsolescence. Now he's like, look, yeah, you're going to save some money because they're much more efficient, going to cost you less in bills, but you're going to be replacing the units more often. So it's for the family, it's going to be about the same. But it's, you know, it's better for the environment. It's better for the electric use, but it's still not making lives better.
Yeah. Yeah, there is that sweet spot of being able to do the energy efficiency and also having the high quality durable good. And so I think that, yeah, I think with that we need to find that. And this is one of the, you probably hear this too. I mean, one of the most frequent comments I get when people talk about American made is like, man, I wish more of my tools and fasteners were American made, because you can tell if it's a, if it's something that's made in China, it just, it just tears right apart or doesn't last. And so, yeah, this idea of having a disposable, cheap economy, time to put that, once and for all in the trash can, just this one time,
yeah.
And then move on to something that looks, feels a little better and is creating good jobs in the process.
Really. Now, this is one of those things where it's interesting you brought up the tools, because I was just having this conversation with my son. I've got a Craftsman ratchet set that I've had since I was his age. I mean, it's yeah. literally, 35 yeah. years old, almost 40. And I've never broken a yeah. socket. We've had yeah. three yeah. of the cheap Chinese made ones, the knockoff ones, bust, in the time that we've yeah. used, the short period that we've used them. So it's perfect to your point. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Scott Paul. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. AmericanManufacturing.org is their website. I got to get your thoughts on what's going on the world stage. Yeah. We obviously Congress is completely broken. The president has asked for money to give to Ukraine, Taiwan and Israel. Clearly no Congress, no House to move that through. But I keep hearing people saying, well, we're just giving all this money away. And I'm not hearing what Mitch McConnell said, is that the majority of that money that we're going to be spending is going to be spent right here at home, rebuilding our arsenal of democracy, if you will, while we're yeah. giving the stuff that we're not using, the obsolete stuff, we're giving that to Ukraine and that. I'm curious your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I don't know how often I agree with Mitch McConnell. I've never counted up the times, but I do agree with him on this. I think he's absolutely right. And this is the thing. And I think this is the problem, is that you have to explain this and sell this, because people hear foreign aid or foreign entanglement. They're like, oh, no, we don't want anything to do with that. But the truth is that there is a lot of value in doing this. And he and others rightfully point out that a lot of these resources will go to ensuring that we have the capability to produce armaments, whether it's missiles, artillery shells, ammunition, at the rate that we need to keep pace, so that those resupply efforts to Ukraine can continue for as long as they need to. And here's the thing that we discovered, is that if, God forbid, we are called into action for something that's beyond a very limited encounter somewhere, whether it's the Middle East or the Pacific, we're going to run out of stuff real fast. And I think that's an alarming discovery to a lot of folks, that we need to have the ability to have a broader industrial base that can produce this pretty rapidly. And I'm not talking about like a massive arms buildup or anything like that, but this is just to keep pace with a tempo that we would need if we're engaged in a conflict like that. And the reason why you need that capability is a deterrence effect, is that yep. the bad actors are less likely to strike if they think that we're going to kick their butts. Right?
No, as I've said a million times, I'm yeah. a Teddy Roosevelt guy on this. I'm a yeah. firm believer. You walk softly, carry a big stick. You yeah. don't mess with us, but if you do, I'm going to go all Paul doctrine on you. Because I believe in that as well, because I think yeah. that's the best deterrent. I may be wrong, but I think that is the best deterrent, knowing that, look, don't screw with us, because hellfire is coming. Yeah. But I don't think we should be bullying and doing the other things that some have said we do. But yeah. we're not involved in these conflicts. We're simply helping people to defend themselves. And I'm all on board with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely agree with all of that, and that we need to project that type of leadership and also demonstrate that kind of deterrence, so that we see fewer of these conflicts in the future rather than more of them. And I think that these are resolved successfully, swiftly, with as little loss of life as possible, but that we don't let the bullies or the terrorists get away with it.
No, absolutely. Right? And the last question I've got for you, and this is obviously a huge question, much, much bigger than, you know, a minute answer. But, you know, I look at what's going on in Ukraine and the fear and the stories that are out there, the fear is that if Putin's allowed to take over Ukraine, you know, China is not far from a decision to go in after Taiwan, which could, one, upset the entire world balance, and two, could make things a whole lot more expensive and more difficult for us here at home. So the idea being, you know, maybe support Ukraine so they don't fall and show the world that we're going to support our allies so that maybe we don't allow China to go in and take over Taiwan.
Yeah, Rick, you're right. It would take more than a minute, but we can get through the biggest points right here. You're absolutely right. And the thing about China, and we need to remember this, is that Russia is a tiny Russia is not a threat to global stability. It is to regional stability, as Ukraine knows, and we need to counter and to crush that. China is a threat to global stability if it decides to project and to take over Taiwan by force, which is not the will of the people there right now. And so we need to set that line, and we need to have that deterrence power. We need to make sure that we have allies on board, and we need to make sure that China would know that there would be tremendous costs if it tried to do something by force. And that's the best deterrent we have right now. And so having that capability, having that outlook is going to be very important as we look ahead.
Yeah, there's a lot on this, and I'm sure you'll come back and you'll keep us up to date. But as always, Scott, I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing your expertise. Thanks so much.
All right. Right back to you, Rick. Thanks so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
Our good friend Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website, if you want to check out the work that they do. They also do an incredible podcast on manufacturing, which I highly suggest. Hope you'll check that out as well. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1940. That was the day that the federally mandated 40-hour work week went into effect for U.S. workers. The 40-hour week had been passed as part of the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. Making 5 days of 8 hours work the national standard had long been a top goal for labor. For decades, union members organized, demonstrated, went on strike, and even died for the right to work 8 hours. Labor argued that reducing the long, unregulated hours of toil was a matter of workers' health and safety. It was also a matter of dignity. A more reasonable work week would give workers the time to spend with their families, to pursue other interests, and to have a full life outside of the grinding schedule demanded by many bosses. Before the turn of the 20th century, the 8-hour day movement declared 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will as their motto. In 1886, nationwide rallies and strikes for 8 hours took place on May 1st. Today, May Day is celebrated as a workers' holiday around the world in remembrance of that struggle. In 1888, the American Federation of Labor took up the cause, and the Carpenters Union became the standard bearer for the 8-hour day. 10 years later, the United Mine Workers Union members won the 8-hour workday. In 1916, the Adamson Act made 8 hours the standard for interstate railroad workers. A decade after that, Ford Motor Company, a leader in U.S. industry, established the 40-hour work week. Each of these victories were a step along the way to making the 8-hour day a reality and the law of the land. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Let's quick go to the phone lines. We got Alice on line one. Alice, how are you today?
Semi-insane.
All right, that's a step forward.
Yeah, I don't know if it's good or not. So what I wanted to say was this. We were talking, or you all were talking, about the planned obsolescence. I can't talk tonight. Anyways, about things breaking easily.
Right.
So, I remember when I was a kid, we had, you know, one of the old televisions, and a tube would go wrong with it every now and then. Dad would take it to the TV shop. They'd throw in a new tube. That thing lasted for 20-some years, 25 years maybe. It was still working when Dad finally bought a new one, a bigger one. A few years ago, my stepson bought my husband for a birthday present one of the big 55-inch screen TVs. It lasted exactly, and I'm not lying to you, 6 months. He had bought it at Walmart. It was one of the ONN ones. ONN is made in Vietnam, but it's actually an offshoot of a Chinese company.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
So I tried to get them because it had supposedly had a one-year warranty on it. I fought with them for over 3 months, the ONN people, not Walmart, send me a back scan of this. I mean, for 3 months, sending all kind of pictures and everything else. Finally, I got disgusted, and I sent an email directly to the Walmart president. And I just, anyways, they ended up replacing it.
Oh, good. Good. I mean, that doesn't happen very often. So you must be one of those people who doggedly goes after them.
Well, I do. I used to have a friend that said I was like a dog with a bone and I would not give up. But
there you go.
The thing is, we're buying this cheap Chinese junk, and we might not even know it's from China because they're expanding. They're in Vietnam. They're here. They're there with all their little subsidiary companies. So, you know, when we had American-made products, they lasted forever. Now you're lucky if you can get 5 years out of something.
I'm with you. Appreciate it, Alice. Thanks so much. No, I mean, and on that front, you know, I go back to, you know, like washing machines, dryers. You know, my grandparents, my grandmother had her entire married life, and my grandparents were married, you know, 60 years. They had three washing machines and three dryers. That's it, three, in their entire lives. I've gone through a couple of them, and that's a problem. That's a problem with how things are built today. And, you know, as this person I know who does HVAC work said, look, it's all cheap. You know, the guts in it are all cheap plastic that break down. And they're made that way. They're made to break down because it's good for profitability. Keeps you coming back, keeps you buying stuff. But they aren't very cheap. That is the problem. Good news coming out of California. I am thrilled to see this. As the state of California has revoked the permit for this company called Cruise. They're the people who do the autonomous vehicles, you know, the ones who supposedly were sending these around the Bay Area, crashing into things, causing traffic nightmares, all kinds of stuff. The state said the California DMV notified Cruise that the department is suspending Cruise's autonomous vehicle deployment and driverless testing permits effective immediately. The DMV has provided the Cruise with the steps needed to apply to reinstate its suspended permits. Now, here's the thing. I'm sorry. The autonomous vehicles, while they may be the future down the road somewhere, they're not the now. And until they're perfect in testing, because you're only going to have a small number of them in testing. If they're not perfect with, you know, one or two, when you put 1,000 or 10,000, you got problems. And look, you know, I have probably one of the best internet systems you can get, and yet sometimes my streaming it buffers. Sometimes it stops. And now imagine if you're driving, you're tooling down the road at 60 miles an hour in a car that you don't have control over, and you know the web stream just goes, I'm going to take a break. Tired. What does that mean? That means chaos. That means trouble. And look, I'm not a Luddite. I'm not against a future of driverless cars. Because look, there's going to be a point in my lifetime. It's probably going to come, you know, I don't know, relatively a lot sooner than I want it to be, where I'm not going to be able to drive myself. And once you lose mobility as an older person, you know, life gets worse. So the idea of autonomous cars to me is an interesting one and a good one. Going to get people to the doctor's appointments, going to do hopefully a lot of really good stuff. Technology's not there yet. And this idea that we're...
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228 Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.